you feel. I had to do something about my longing, so I got up, went to the kitchen in my nightgown, peeled a pound of potatoes, boiled them up, sliced them, fried them in butter, salted them generously, and ate every bite of them, asking my body the whole time if it would please accept the satisfaction of a pound of fried potatoes in lieu of the fulfillment of lovemaking. My body replied, only after eating every bite of the food, "No deal, babe." So I climbed back into bed, sighed in boredom, and commenced to... Well, a word about masturbation, if I may. Sometimes it can be a handy, forgive me, tool, but other times it can be so acutely unsatisfying that it only makes you feel worse in the end. After a year and a half of celibacy, after a year and a half of calling my own name in my bed built for one, I was getting a little sick of the sport. Still, tonight, in my restless state, what else could I do? The potatoes hadn't worked. So I had my way with myself yet again. As usual, my mind paged through its backlog of erotic files, looking for the right fantasy or memory that would help get the job done fastest. But nothing was really working tonight. Not the firemen, not the pirates, not that pervy old Bill Clinton standby scene that usually does the trick, not even the Victorian gentlemen crowding around me in their drawing room with their task force of nubile young maids. In the end, the only thing that would satisfy was when I reluctantly admitted into my mind the idea of my good friend from Brazil climbing into this bed with me, on me. Then I slept. I woke to a quiet blue sky and an even quieter bedroom. Still feeling unsettled and unbalanced, I took a long stretch of my morning and chanted the entire 182 Sanskrit verses of the Guru Gita, the great purifying fundamental hymn of my ashram in India. Then I meditated for an hour of bone-tingling stillness until finally I felt it again, that specific, constant, clear sky, unrelated to anything, never-shifting, nameless and changeless perfection of my own happiness. That happiness which is better, truly, than anything I have ever experienced anywhere else on this earth, and that includes salty, buttery kisses, and even saltier and more buttery potatoes. I was so glad I had made the decision to stay alone. 97. So I was kind of surprised the next night when, after he had made me dinner at his house, and after we had sprawled on his couch for several hours and discussed all manner of subjects, and after he'd unexpectedly leaned into me for a moment and sunk his face toward my armpit and pronounced how much he loved the marvelous dirty stink of me, Felipe finally put his palm against my cheek and said, "That's enough, darling. Come to my bed now." And I did. Yes, I did come to his bed with him, in that quiet bedroom, with its big open windows looking out over the nighttime and the quiet Balinese rice fields. He parted the sheer white curtain of mosquito netting that surrounded his bed and guided me in there. Then he helped me out of my dress with the tender competence of a man who had obviously spent many comfortable years getting his children ready for bath time. And he explained to me his terms, that he wanted absolutely nothing from me whatsoever, except permission to adore me for as long as I wanted him to. Were those terms acceptable to me? Having lost my voice somewhere between the couch and the bed, I only nodded. There was nothing left to say. It had been a long, austere season of solitude. I had done well for myself, but Felipe was right. That was enough. "Okay," he replied, smiling as he moved some pillows out of our way and rolled my body under his. "Let's get ourselves organized here." Which was actually pretty funny, because that moment marked an end to all my efforts at organization. Later, Felipe would tell me how he had seen me that night. He said that I seemed so young, not in the least bit resembling the self-assured woman he'd come to know in the daylight world. He said I seemed terribly young, but also open and excited and relieved to be recognized and so tired of being brave. He said it was obvious I hadn't been touched in such a long time. He found me teeming with need, but also grateful to be allowed to express that need. And while I can't say that I remember all that, I do take his word for it, because he seemed to be paying awfully close attention to me. What I mostly remember about that night is the billowy white mosquito netting that surrounded us, how it looked to me like a parachute, and how I felt like I was now deploying this parachute to escort me out the side exit of the solid, disciplined airplane which had been flying me during these few years out of a very hard time in my life. But now, my sturdy flying machine had become obsolete right there in midair. So I stepped out of that single-minded, single-engine airplane and let this fluttering white parachute swing me down through the strange, empty atmosphere between my past and my future, and land me safely on this small, bed-shaped island inhabited only by this handsome, shipwrecked Brazilian sailor who, having been alone himself for far too long, was so happy and so surprised to see me coming that he suddenly forgot all his English and could only manage to repeat these five words every time he looked at my face. Beautiful, 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 and beautiful. 98. We didn't sleep at all, of course, and then it was ridiculous. I had to go. I had to go back to my house stupidly early the next morning because I had a date to meet my friend Uday. He and I had long ago planned that this was the very week we were going to leave on a big cross-Balinese road trip together. This was an idea we'd come up with one evening at my house when Uday said that, aside from his wife and Manhattan, what he most missed about America was driving, just taking off with a car and some friends and going on an adventure across those great distances on all those fabulous interstate highways. I told him, okay, so we'll have a road trip here in Bali together, American style. This had struck us both as irresistibly comic. There's no way you can do an American style road trip in Bali. There are no great distances, first of all, on an island the size of Delaware. And the highways are horrible, made surreally dangerous by the dense, mad prevalence of Bali's version of the American family minivan, a small motorcycle with five people crowded on it, the father driving with one hand while holding the newborn infant with the other, football-like, while mom sits side-saddle behind him in her tight sarong with a basket balanced on her head, encouraging her twin toddlers not to fall off the speeding motorbike, which is probably traveling on the wrong side of the road and has no headlight. Helmets are rarely worn, but are frequently, and I never did find out why, carried. Imagine scores of these heavily laden motorcycles, all speeding recklessly, all weaving and dodging across each other like some kind of crazy motorized maypole dance, and you have life on the Balinese highways. I don't know why every single Balinese person hasn't been killed already in a road accident. But Uday and I decided to do it anyway, to take off for a week, rent a car, and drive all over this tiny island, pretending that we are in America and that both of us are free. This idea charmed me when we came up with it last month, but the timing of it now, as I am lying in bed with Felipe and he's kissing my fingertips and forearms and shoulders and encouraging me to linger, seems unfortunate. But I have to go. And in a way, I do want to go. Not only to spend a week with my friend Uday, but also as a repose after my big night with Felipe. To get my head around the new reality that, as they say in the novels, I have taken a lover. So Felipe drops me off at my house with one last passionate embrace, and I have just enough time to shower and pull myself together when Uday arrives with our rental car. He takes one look at me and says, "Dude, what time did you get home last night?" I say, "Dude, I didn't get home last night." He says, "Dude," and starts laughing, probably remembering the conversation we'd had only about 2 weeks earlier, wherein I had seriously posited that I might never actually have sex again for the rest of my life, ever. He says, "So you gave in, huh?" "Uday," I replied, "let me tell you a story. Last summer before I left the States, I went to visit my grandparents in upstate New York. My grandfather's wife, his second wife, is this really nice lady named Gail, in her 80s now. She hauled out this old photo album and showed me pictures from the 1930s when she was 18 years old and went on a trip to Europe for a year with her two best friends and a guardian. So she's flipping through these pages, showing me these amazing old photographs of Italy, And suddenly we get to this picture of this really cute young Italian guy in Venice. I go, Gail, who's the hottie? She goes, that's the son of the people who owned the hotel where we stayed in Venice. He was my boyfriend. I go, your boyfriend? And my grandfather's sweet wife looks at me all sly, and her eyes get all sexy like Betty Davis, and she goes, I was tired of looking at churches, Liz. Uday gives me a high five. Rock on, dude. We set off for our fake American road trip across Bali, me and this cool young Indonesian musical genius in exile, the back of our car filled with guitars and beer and the Balinese equivalent of American road trip food, fried rice crackers and dreadfully flavored indigenous candies. The details of our journey are a bit blurry to me now, smudged over by my distracting thoughts of Felipe and by the weird haziness that always accompanies a road trip in any country of the world. What I do remember is that Uday and I speak American the entire time, a language I hadn't spoken in so long. I'd been speaking a lot of English during this year, of course, but not American, and definitely not the sort of hip-hop American Uday likes. So we just indulge it, turning ourselves into MTV-watching adolescents as we drive along, razzing each other like teenagers in Hoboken, calling each other dude and man, and sometimes, with great tenderness, homo. A lot of our dialogue revolves around affectionate insults toward each other's mothers. Dude, what'd you do with the map? Why don't you ask your mother what I did with the map, dude? I would, man, but she's too fat. And so forth. We don't even penetrate the interior of Bali. We just drive along the coast, and it's beaches, beaches, beaches for the whole week. Sometimes we take a little fishing boat out to an island and see what's going on out there. There are so many kinds of beaches in Bali. We hang out one day along the long Southern California-style groovy white sand surf of Kuta, then head up to the sinister black rocky beauty of the West Coast. Then we pass that invisible Balinese dividing line over which regular tourists never seem to go, up to the wild beaches of the North Coast, where only the surfers dare to tread, and only the crazy ones at that. We sit on the beach and watch the dangerous waves, watch the lean brown and white Indonesian and Western surf cats slice across the water like zippers ripping open the backs of the ocean's blue party dress. We watch the surfers wipe out with bone-breaking hubris against the coral and rocks, only to go back out again to surf another wave, and we gasp and say, dude, that is totally messed up. Just as intended, we forget for long hours, purely for Uday's benefit, that we are in Indonesia at all, as we tool around in this rental car, eating junk food and singing American songs, having pizza everywhere we can find it. When we are overcome by evidence of the Bali-ness of our surroundings, we try to ignore it and pretend we're back in America. I'll say, what's the best route to get past this volcano? And Uday will say, I think we should take I-95. And I'll counter, but that'll take us right through Boston in the middle of rush hour traffic. It's just a game, but it sort of works. Sometimes we discover calm stretches of blue ocean, and we swim all day, permitting each other to start drinking beer at 10 a.m. Dude, it's medicinal. We make friends with everyone we encounter. Uday is the kind of guy who, when he's walking down the beach and he sees a man building a boat, will stop and say, wow, are you building a boat? And his curiosity is so perfectly winning that the next thing you know, we've been invited to come live with the boat builder's family for a year. Weird things happen in the evenings. We stumble on mysterious temple rituals in the middle of nowhere, let ourselves get hypnotized by the chorus of voices, drums, and gamelan. We find one seaside town where all the locals have gathered in a darkened street for a birthday ceremony. Uday and I are both pulled out of the crowd, honored strangers, and invited to dance with the prettiest girl in the village. She's enveloped in gold and jewels and incense and Egyptian-looking makeup. She's probably 13 years old, but moves her hips with the soft, sensual faith of a creature who knows she could seduce any god she wanted. The next day, we find a strange family restaurant in the same village where the Balinese proprietor announces that he's a great chef of Thai food, which he decidedly is not. But we spend the whole day there anyhow, drinking icy Cokes and eating greasy pad thai and playing Milton Bradley board games with the owner's elegantly effeminate teenage son. It occurs to us only later that this pretty teenage boy could well have been the beautiful female dancer from the night before. The Balinese are masters of ritual transvestism. Every day, I call Felipe from whatever outback phone I can find, and he asks, "How many more sleeps until you come back to me?" He tells me, "I'm enjoying falling in love with you, darling. It feels so natural, like it's something I experience every second week. But actually, I haven't felt this way about anyone in nearly 30 years. Not there yet. Not yet to that place of a free fall into love. I make hesitant noises, little reminders that I am leaving in a few months. Felipe is unconcerned. He says, "Maybe this is just some stupid romantic South American idea, but I need you to understand, darling, for you, I am even willing to suffer. Whatever pain happens to us in the future, I accept it already, just for the pleasure of being with you now. Let's enjoy this time. It's marvelous." I tell him, "You know, it's funny, but I'd been seriously thinking before I met you that I might be alone and celibate forever. I was thinking maybe I would live the life of a spiritual contemplative." He says, "Contemplate this, darling," and then proceeds to detail with careful specificity the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth things he is planning to do with my body when he gets me alone in his bed again. I wobble away from the phone call, a little woozy in the knees, amused and bamboozled by all this new passion. The last day of our road trip, Uday and I lounge on a beach someplace for hours, and, as often happens with us, we start talking about New York City again, how great it is, how much we love it. Uday misses the city, he says, almost as much as he misses his wife, as if New York is a person, a relative, whom he has lost since he got deported. As we're talking, Uday brushes off a nice clean patch of white sand between our towels and draws a map of Manhattan. He says, "Let's try to fill in everything we can remember about the city." We use our fingers to draw in all the avenues, the major cross streets, the mess that Broadway makes as it leans crookedly across the island, the rivers, the village, Central Park. We choose a thin, pretty seashell to stand for the Empire State Building, and another shell is the Chrysler Building. Out of respect, we take two sticks and put the twin towers back at the base of the island, back where they belong. We use this sandy map to show each other our favorite spots in New York. This is where Uday bought the sunglasses he's wearing right now. This is where I bought the sandals I'm wearing. This is where I first had dinner with my ex-husband. This is where Uday met his wife. This is the best Vietnamese food in the city. This is the best bagel. This is the best noodle shop. No way, homo. This is the best noodle shop. I sketch out my old Hell's Kitchen neighborhood, and Uday says, "I know a good diner up there." "TikTok, Cheyenne, or Starlight?" I ask. "TikTok, dude." "Ever tried the egg creams at TikTok?" I ask. He moans, "Oh my God, I know." I feel his longing for New York so deeply that for a moment I mistake it for my own. His homesickness infects me so completely that I forget for an instant that I am actually free to go back to Manhattan someday, though he is not. He fiddles a bit with the two sticks of the Twin Towers, anchors them more solidly in the sand, then looks out at the hushed blue ocean and says, "I know it's beautiful here, but do you think I'll ever get to see America again?" What can I tell him? We slump into silence. Then he pops out of his mouth the yucky Indonesian hard candy he's been sucking on for the last hour and says, "Dude, this candy tastes like ass. Where'd you get it?" "From your mother, dude," I say. "From your mother." 99. When we return to Ubud, I go straight back to Felipe's house and don't leave his bedroom for approximately another month. This is only the faintest of exaggerations. I have never been loved and adored like this before by anyone, never with such pleasure and single-minded concentration. Never have I been so unpeeled, revealed, unfurled, and hurled through the event of lovemaking. One thing I do know about intimacy is that there are certain natural laws which govern the sexual experience of two people, and that these laws cannot be budged any more than gravity can be negotiated with. To feel physically comfortable with someone else's body is not a decision you can make. It has very little to do with how two people think or act or talk or even look. The mysterious magnet is either there, buried somewhere deep behind the sternum, or it is not. When it isn't there, as I have learned in the past with heartbreaking clarity, you can no more force it to exist than a surgeon can force a patient's body to accept a kidney from the wrong donor. My friend Annie says it all comes down to one simple question. Do you want your belly pressed against this person's belly forever or not? Felipe and I, as we discover to our delight, are a perfectly matched, genetically engineered, belly-to-belly success story. There are no parts of our bodies which are in any way allergic to any parts of the other's body. Nothing is dangerous, nothing is difficult, nothing is refused. Everything in our sensual universe is so simply and thoroughly complemented. Look at you, Felipe says, taking me back to the mirror after we've made love again, showing me my nude body and my hair that looks like I just came through a NASA space training centrifuge. He says, look how beautiful you are. Every line of you is a curve. You look like sand dunes. Indeed, I do not think my body has looked or felt this relaxed in its life. Not since I was maybe 6 months old and my mother took snapshots of me all blissed out on a towel on the kitchen counter after a nice bath in the kitchen sink. And then he leads me back to the bed, saying in Portuguese, Vem gostosa. Come here, my delicious one. Felipe is the endearment master. In bed, he slips into adoring me in Portuguese, so I have graduated from being his lovely little darling to being his queridinha. Literal translation, lovely little darling. I've been too lazy here in Bali to try to learn Indonesian or Balinese, but suddenly Portuguese is coming easily to me. Of course, I'm only learning the pillow talk, but that's a fine use of Portuguese. He says, darling, you're going to get sick of it. You're going to get bored of how much I touch you and how many times a day I tell you how beautiful you are. Try me, mister. I'm losing days here, disappearing under his sheets, under his hands. I like the feeling of not knowing what the date is. My nicely organized schedule has been blown away by the breeze. I do finally stop by to see my medicine man one afternoon after a long hiatus of no visiting. Ketut sees the truth on my face before I say a word. You found boyfriend in Bali, he says. Yes, Ketut. Good. Be careful not get pregnant. I will. He good man? You tell me, Ketut, I said. You read his palm. You promised that he was a good man. You said it about 7 times. I did? When? Back in June, I brought him here. He was the Brazilian man, older than me. You told me you liked him. Never did, he insisted, and there was nothing I could do to convince him otherwise. Sometimes Ketut loses things from his recollection, as you would, too, if you were somewhere between 65 and 112 years old. Most of the time he's keen and sharp, but other times I feel like I've disturbed him out of some other plane of consciousness, out of some other universe. A few weeks ago, he said to me, completely out of nowhere, "You good friend to me, Liz, loyal friend, loving friend." Then he sighed, stared off into space, and added mournfully, "Not like Sharon." Who the hell is Sharon? What did she do to him? When I tried asking him about it, he would give me no answer, acted suddenly like he didn't know who I was even referring to, as if I were the one who'd brought up that thieving hussy Sharon in the first place. "Why you never bring boyfriend here to meet me?" he asked now. "I did, Ketut, really I did, and you told me you liked him." "Don't remember. He rich man, your boyfriend?" "No, Ketut, he's not a rich man, but he has enough money."
"Medium rich?"
"The medicine man wants details, spreadsheets." "He has enough money," I said. My answer seemed to irritate Ketut.
"You ask this man for money he can give you or not?"
Ketut, I don't want money from him. I've never taken money from a man.
You spend every night with him?
Yes.
Good. He spoil you?
Very much.
Good. You still meditate?
Yes, I do still meditate, every day of the week, slithering out of Felipe's bed and over to the couch, where I can sit in silence and offer up some gratitude for all of this. Outside his porch, the ducks quack their way through the rice paddies, gossiping and splashing all over the place. Felipe says that these flocks of busy Balinese ducks have always reminded him of Brazilian women strutting down the beaches in Rio, chatting loudly and interrupting each other constantly, and waggling their bottoms with such pride. I am so relaxed now that I kind of slide into meditation, like it's a bath prepared by my lover. Naked in the morning sun, with nothing but a light blanket wrapped over my shoulders, I disappear into grace, hovering over the void like a tiny seashell balanced on a teaspoon. Why did life ever seem difficult? I call my friend Susan back in New York City one day and listen as she confides to me, over the typical urban police sirens wailing in the background, the latest details of her latest broken heart. My voice comes out in the cool, smooth tones of a late-night jazz radio DJ as I tell her how she just has to let go, man, how she's got to learn that everything is just perfect as it is already, that the universe provides, baby, that it's all peace and harmony out there. I can almost hear her rolling her eyes as she says, over the sirens, spoken like a woman who already had 4 orgasms today. 100. But all the fun and games caught up with me after a few weeks. After all those nights of not sleeping and all those days of too much lovemaking, my body struck back and I got attacked by a nasty infection in my bladder. A typical affliction of the overly sexed, especially likely to strike when you're not used to being overly sexed anymore. It came up as fast as any tragedy can strike. I was walking through town one morning, doing some chores, when suddenly I was buckled over with burning pain and fever. I'd had these infections before, during my wayward youth, so I knew what it was. I panicked for a moment. These things can be awful. But then thought, thank God my best friend in Bali is a healer, and I ran into Wyan's shop. I'm sick, I said. She took one look at me and said, you sick from making too much sex, Liz. I groaned, buried my face in my hands, embarrassed. She chuckled, said, you can't keep secrets from YN. I was in god-awful pain. Anyone who's ever had this infection knows the dreadful feeling. Anyone who hasn't experienced the specific suffering, well, just make up your own torturous metaphor, preferably using the term fire poker someplace in the sentence. YN, like a veteran firefighter or an ER surgeon, never moves fast. She methodically started chopping some herbs, boiling some roots, wandering back and forth between her kitchen and me, bringing me one warm, brown, toxic-tasting concoction after another and saying, drink, honey. Whenever the next batch boiled, she would sit down across from me, giving me sly, dirty looks and using the opportunity to get nosy. You careful not get pregnant, Liz? Not possible, YN. Felipe has a vasectomy. Felipe has a vasectomy? She asked, in much the same awe as if she were asking, Felipe has a villa in Tuscany? I feel the same way about it, by the way. Very difficult in Bali to get man to do this. Always the woman problem, birth control. Although it is true that the Indonesian birth rates are down lately due to a brilliant recent birth control incentive program, the government promised a new motorcycle to every man who would volunteer to come in for a vasectomy, though I hate to think these guys had to ride their new bikes home the same day. Sex is funny, Wyan mused as she watched me grimacing in pain, drinking more of her homemade medicine. Yeah, Wyan, thanks. It's hilarious. No, sex is funny, she went on. Make people do funny things. Everyone gets like this at the beginning of love, wanting too much happiness, too much pleasure, until you make yourself sick. Even to YN this happens at beginning of love story. Lose balance. I'm embarrassed, I say. Don't, she said. Then she added in perfect English and perfect Balinese logic, to lose balance sometimes for love is part of living a balanced life. I decided to call Felipe. I had some antibiotics at the house, an emergency stash I always travel with just in case. Having had these infections before, I know how bad they can get, even traveling up into your kidneys. I didn't want to go through that, not in Indonesia. So I called him and told him what had happened. He was mortified, and asked him to bring over some of the pills. It wasn't that I didn't trust Wyan's healing prowess. It's just that this was really serious pain. She said, you don't need Western pills. But maybe it's better, Wyan, just to be safe. Give 2 hours, she said. If I don't make you better, you can take pills. Reluctantly, I agreed. My experience with these infections is that they can take days to clear, even with strong antibiotics. but I didn't want to make her feel bad. Tutti was playing in the shop, and she kept bringing little drawings of houses over to cheer me up, patting my hand with an 8-year-old's compassion. Mama Elizabeth sick? At least she didn't know what I'd been doing to get sick. Did you buy your house yet, Wayan? I asked. Not yet, honey. No hurry. What about that place you liked? I thought you were going to buy it. Found out not for sale, too expensive. Do you have other places in mind? Not worry about it now, Liz. For now, let me make you feel quickly better. Felipe arrived with my medicine and a face full of remorse, apologizing to both me and Wayan for having inflicted me with this pain, or at least that's how he was seeing it. Not serious, said Wayan. Not worry, I fix her soon, quickly better. Then she went into the kitchen and produced a giant glass mixing bowl full of leaves, roots, berries, something I recognized as turmeric, some shaggy mass of something that looked like witch's hair, plus eye of what I believe might have been newt, all floating in its own brown juice. There was about a gallon of it in the bowl, whatever it was. It stank like a corpse. Drink, honey, said Wayan. Drink all. I suffered it down, and in less than 2 hours, well, we all know how this story ends. In less than 2 hours, I was fine, totally healed. An infection that would have taken days to treat with Western antibiotics was gone. I tried to pay her for having fixed me up, but she only laughed. My sister doesn't need to pay. Then she turned on Felipe, fake stern. You be careful with her now. Only sleep tonight. No touching. You're not embarrassed to fix people for problems like this, from sex? I asked Wayan. Liz, I'm a healer. I fix all problems, with women's vaginas, with men's bananas. Sometimes for women I even make fake penises for making sex alone. Dildos? I asked, shocked. Not everybody has Brazilian boyfriend, Liz, she admonished. Then she looked at Felipe and said brightly, If you ever need help making stiff your banana, I can give you medicine. I was busily assuring Wayan that Felipe needed not one bit of help with his banana, but he interrupted me, always the entrepreneur, to ask Wayan if this banana-stiffening therapy of hers could perhaps be bottled and marketed. We could make a fortune, he said. But she explained, no, it's not like that. All her medicines must be made fresh each day in order to work, and they must be accompanied by her prayers. Anyway, internal medicine is not the only way Wayan can firm up a man's banana, she assured us. She can also do this with massage. Then, to our lurid fascination, she described the different massages she does for men's impotent bananas, how she grips along the base of the thing and kind of shakes it around for about an hour to encourage the blood to flow while incanting special prayers. I asked, But Wayan, what happens when the man comes back every day and says, Still not cured, doctor, need another banana massage? She laughed at this bawdy idea and admitted that, yes, she has to be careful not to spend too much time fixing men's bananas because it causes a certain amount of strong feeling within her, which she isn't sure is good for the healing energy. And sometimes, yes, the men do get out of control. As you would, too, if you'd been impotent for years and suddenly this beautiful mahogany-skinned woman with long, black, silky hair gets the engine to turn over again. She told us about the one man who leapt up and started chasing her around the room during an impotency cure, saying, I need Wayan! I need Wayan! But that's not all Wayan can do. Also, she told us, she is sometimes called upon to be a teacher of sex, for a couple who are either struggling with impotence or frigidity, or who are having trouble making a baby. She has to draw magic pictures on their bedsheets and explain to them which sexual positions are appropriate for which time of the month. She said that if a man wants to make a baby, he should make intercourse with his wife really, really hard and should shoot water out of his banana into her vagina really, really fast. Sometimes Wayan has to actually be there in the room with the copulating couple, explaining just how hard and fast this must be done. I ask, and is the man able to shoot water out of his banana really hard and really fast with Dr. Wayan standing over him watching? Felipe imitates Wayan watching the couple. Faster! Harder! You want this baby or not? Wayan says yes, she knows it's crazy, but this is the job of the healer. though she admits it requires a whole lot of purification ceremonies before and after this event in order to keep her sacred spirit intact, and she doesn't like to do it very often because it makes her feel funny. But if a baby needs to be conceived, she will take care of it. And do these couples all have babies now? I asked. Have babies, she confirmed with pride. Of course they do. But then Wyan confides something extremely interesting. She said that if a couple is not having any luck conceiving a child, she will examine both the man and the woman to determine who is, as they say, to blame. If it's the woman, no problem. Wyan can fix this with ancient healing techniques. But if it's the man, well, this presents a delicate situation here in the patriarchy of Bali. Wyan's medical options here are limited because it is beyond the pale of safety to inform a Balinese man that he is sterile. It cannot possibly be true. Men are men, after all. If no pregnancy is occurring, it has to be the woman's fault. And if the woman doesn't provide her husband with a baby soon, she could be in big trouble, beaten, shamed, or divorced. So what do you do in that situation, I asked, impressed that a woman who still calls semen banana water could diagnose male infertility. Wyan told us all. What she does in the case of male infertility is to inform the man that his wife is infertile and needs to be seen privately every afternoon for healing sessions. When the wife comes to the shop alone, Wyan calls some young stud from the village to come over and have sex with her, hopefully creating a baby. Felipe was appalled. Wyan! No! But she just calmly nodded. Yes. It's the only way. If wife is healthy, she will have baby. Then everybody happy. Felipe immediately wanted to know, since he lives in this town, who? Who do you hire to do this job? Wyan said, the drivers. Which made us all laugh because Ubud is full of these young guys, these drivers, who sit on every corner and harass passing tourists with the never-ending sales pitch. Transport? Transport? Trying to make a buck driving folks out of town to the volcanoes, the beaches, or the temples. Generally speaking, this is a fairly good-looking crowd, what with their fine Gauguin skin, toned bodies, and groovy long hair. You could make a nice bit of money in America operating a fertility clinic for women staffed with beautiful guys like this. Wyan says the best thing about her infertility treatment is that the drivers generally don't even ask for payment for their sexual transport services, especially if the wife is really cute. Felipe and I agree that this is quite generous and community-spirited of the fellows. 9 months later, a beautiful baby is born, and everyone is happy. Best of all, no need to cancel the marriage. And we all know how horrible it is to cancel a marriage, especially in Bali. Felipe said, my God, what suckers we men are. But Wyan is unapologetic. This treatment is only necessary because it's not possible to tell a Balinese man that he is infertile without risking that he will go home and do something terrible to his wife. If men in Bali weren't like this, she could cure their infertility in other ways. But this is the reality of the culture, so there it is. She doesn't have the tiniest shred of bad conscience about it, but thinks it's just another way of being a creative healer. Anyway, she adds, it's sometimes nice for the wife to make sex with one of those cool drivers, because most husbands in Bali don't know how to make love to a woman anyway. Most husbands is like roosters, like goats. I suggested, well, maybe you should teach sex education class, Wyan. You could teach men how to touch women in a soft way. Then maybe their wives would like sex more. Because if a man really touches you gently, caresses your skin, says loving things, kisses you all over your body, takes his time, sex can be nice. Suddenly, she blushed. Wyan Noriasi, this banana-massaging, bladder-infection-treating, dildo-peddling, small-time pimp, actually blushed. You make me feel funny when you talk like that, she said, fanning herself. This talking, it make me feel different. Even in my underpants, I feel different. Go home now, you both. No more talk like this about sex. Go home. Go to bed. But only sleeping, okay? Only sleeping. 101. On the ride home, Felipe asked, has she bought a house yet? Not yet, I said, but she's looking. It's been over a month already since you gave her the money, hasn't it?
Yes, but the place she wanted, it wasn't for sale.
Be careful, darling, Felipe said. Don't let this drag out too long. Don't let this situation get all Balinese on you.
What does that mean?
I'm not trying to interfere in your business, but I've lived in this country for 5 years and I know how things are. Stories can get complicated around here. Sometimes it's hard to get the truth of what's actually happening.
What are you trying to say, Felipe? I asked.
And when he didn't answer me immediately, I quoted to him one of his own signature lines. If you tell me slowly, I can understand quickly.
What I'm trying to say, Liz, is that your friends have raised an awful lot of money for this woman, and right now it's all sitting in Wyan's bank account. Make sure she actually buys a house with it.
102. The end of July came, and my 35th birthday with it. Wyan threw a birthday party for me in her shop, quite unlike any I have ever experienced before. Wyan had dressed me in a traditional Balinese birthday suit, a bright purple sarong, a strapless bustier, and a long length of golden fabric that she wrapped tightly around my torso, forming a sheath so snug I could barely take a breath or eat my own birthday cake. As she was mummifying me into this exquisite costume in her tiny dark bedroom, crowded with the belongings of the three other little human beings who live there with her, she asked, not quite looking at me, but doing some fancy tucking and pinning of material around my ribs,
"You have prospect to marrying Felipe?"
"No," I said. "We have no prospects for marrying. I don't want any more husbands, Wyan, and I don't think Felipe wants any more wives, but I like being with him."
"Handsome on outside is easy to find, but handsome on outside and handsome on inside, this is not easy. Felipe has this."
I agreed.
She smiled. "And who bring this good man to you, Liz? Who prayed every day for this man?"
I kissed her. "Thank you, Wyan. You did a good job." We commenced to the birthday party. Wyan and the kids had decorated the whole place with balloons and palm fronds and handwritten signs with complex, run-on sentences like, "Happy birthday to a nice and sweet heart, to you, our dearest sister, to our beloved Lady Elizabeth, happy birthday to you, always peace to you, and happy birthday." Wyan has a brother whose young children are gifted dancers in temple ceremonies, and so the nieces and nephews came and danced for me right there in the restaurant, staging a haunting, gorgeous performance usually offered only to priests. All the children were decked out in gold and massive headdresses, decorated in fierce drag queen makeup, with powerful stamping feet and graceful feminine fingers. Balinese parties as a whole are generally organized around the principle of people getting dressed up in their finest clothes, then sitting around and staring at each other. It's a lot like magazine parties in New York, actually.
"My God, darling," moaned Felipe when I told him that Wyan was throwing me a Balinese birthday party. "It's going to be so boring."
It wasn't boring, though, just quiet and different. There was the whole dressing up part, and then there was the whole dance performance part, and then there was the whole sitting around and staring at each other part, which wasn't so bad. Everyone did look lovely. Wyan's whole family had come, and they kept smiling and waving at me from 4 feet away, and I kept smiling at them and waving back at them. I blew out the candles of the birthday cake along with little Katut, the smallest orphan, whose birthday, I had decided a few weeks ago, would also be on July 18th from now on, shared with my own, since she'd never had a birthday or a birthday party before. After we blew out the candles, Felipe presented little Katut with a Barbie doll, which she unwrapped in stunned wonder and then regarded as though it were a ticket for a rocket ship to Jupiter, something she never, ever in 7 billion light years could have imagined receiving. Everything about this party was kind of funny. It was an oddball international and multi-generational mix of a handful of my friends, Wyan's family, and some of her Western clients and patients whom I'd never met before. My friend Uday brought me a six-pack of beer to wish me happy birthday, and also this cool young hipster screenwriter from L.A. named Adam came by. Felipe and I had met Adam in a bar the other night and had invited him. Adam and Uday passed their time at the party talking to a little boy named John, whose mother is a patient of Wyan's, a German clothing designer married to an American who lives in Bali. Little John, who is 7 years old and who is kind of American, he says, because of his American dad, even though he himself has never been there, but who speaks German with his mother and speaks Indonesian with Wayan's children, was smitten with Adam because he'd found out that the guy was from California and could surf. "What's your favorite animal, mister?" asked John, and Adam replied, "Pelicans." "What's a pelican?" the little boy asked, and Uday jumped in and said, "Dude, you don't know what a pelican is? Dude, you gotta go home and ask your dad about that. Pelicans rock, dude." Then John, the kind of American boy, turned to say something in Indonesian to little Tuti, probably to ask her what a pelican was, as Tuti sat in Felipe's lap trying to read my birthday cards while Felipe was speaking beautiful French to a retired gentleman from Paris who comes to Wayan for kidney treatments. Meanwhile, Wayan had turned on the radio, and Kenny Rogers was singing Coward of the County while three Japanese girls wandered in randomly to the shop to see if they could get medicinal massages. As I tried to talk the Japanese girls into eating some of my birthday cake, the two orphans, Big Katut and Little Katut, were decorating my hair with the giant spangled barrettes they'd saved up all their money to buy me as a gift. Wayan's nieces and nephews, the child temple dancers, the children of rice farmers, sat very still, tentatively staring at the floor, dressed in gold like miniature deities. They imbued the room with a strange and otherworldly godliness. Outside, the rooster started crowing, even though it was not yet evening, not yet dusk. My traditional Balinese clothing was squeezing me like an ardent hug, and I was feeling like this was definitely the strangest, but maybe the happiest, birthday party I'd ever experienced in my whole life. 103. Still, Wayan needs to buy a house, and I'm getting worried that it's not happening. I don't understand why it's not happening, but it absolutely needs to happen. Felipe and I have stepped in now. We found a realtor who could take us around and show us properties, but Wayan hasn't liked anything we've shown her. I keep telling her, "Wayan, it's important that we buy something. I'm leaving here in September, and I need to let my friends know before I leave that their money actually went into a home for you, and you need to get a roof over your head before you get evicted." "Not so simple to buy land in Bali," she keeps telling me. "Not like to walk into a bar and buy a beer. Can take a long time." "We don't have a long time, Wayan." She just shrugs, and I remember again about the Balinese concept of rubber time, meaning that time is a very relative and bouncy idea. 4 weeks doesn't really mean to Wayan what it means to me. 1 day to Wayan isn't necessarily composed of 24 hours either. Sometimes it's longer, sometimes it's shorter, depending upon the spiritual and emotional nature of that day. As with my medicine man and his mysterious age, sometimes you count the days, sometimes you weigh them. Meanwhile, it also turns out that I have completely underestimated how expensive it is to buy property in Bali. Because everything is so cheap here, you would assume that land is also undervalued, but that's a mistaken assumption. To buy land in Bali, especially in Ubud, can get almost as expensive as buying land in Westchester County, in Tokyo, or on Rodeo Drive. Which is completely illogical, because once you own the property, you can't make your money back on it in any traditionally logical way. You may pay approximately $25,000 for an aro of land. An aro is a land measurement roughly translating into English as slightly bigger than the parking spot for an SUV. And then you can build a little shop there where you will sell one batik sarong a day to one tourist a day for the rest of your life for a profit of about 75 cents a hit. It's senseless. But the Balinese value their land with a passion that extends beyond the reaches of economic sense. Since land ownership is traditionally the only wealth that Balinese recognize as legitimate, property is valued in the same way as the Maasai value cattle, or as my 5-year-old niece values lip gloss, namely that you cannot have enough of it, that once you have claimed it, you must never let it go, and that all of it in the world should rightfully belong to you. Moreover, as I discovered during the month of August, during my Narnia-like voyage into the intricacies of Indonesian real estate, it's almost impossible to find out when land is actually for sale around here. Balinese who are selling land typically don't like other people to know that their land is for sale. Now, you would think it might be advantageous to advertise this fact, but the Balinese don't see it that way. If you're a Balinese farmer and you're selling your land, it means you are desperate for cash, and this is humiliating. Also, if your neighbors and family find out that you actually sold some land, then they'll assume that you came into some money, and everybody will be asking if they can borrow that money. So land becomes available for sale only by rumor. And all of these land deals are executed under strange veils of secrecy and deception. The Western expatriates around here, hearing that I'm trying to buy land for Wyan, start gathering around me, offering cautionary tales based on their own nightmarish experiences. They warn me that you can never really be certain what's going on when it comes to real estate around here. The land you are buying might not actually belong to the person who is selling it. The guy who showed you the property might not even be the owner, but only the disgruntled nephew of the owner, trying to get one over on his uncle because of some old family dispute. Don't expect that the boundaries of your property will ever be clear. The land you buy for your dream house may later be declared to be too close to a temple to allow a building permit. And it's difficult in this small country with an estimated 20,000 temples to find any land that is not too close to a temple. Also, you must take into consideration that you're quite probably living on the slopes of a volcano, and you might be straddling a fault line as well. And not just a geological fault line either. As idyllic as Bali seems, the wise keep in mind that this is, in fact, Indonesia, the largest Islamic nation on earth, unstable at its core, corrupt from the highest ministers of justice all the way down to the guy who pumps gas into your car and who only pretends to fill it up all the way. Some kind of revolution will always be possible here at any moment, and all your assets may be reclaimed by the victors, probably at gunpoint. Negotiating all this dodgy business is not something I have any qualifications whatsoever to be doing. I mean, I went through a divorce proceeding in New York State and everything, but this is another page out of Kafka altogether. Meanwhile, $18,000 of money donated by me, my family, and my dearest friends is sitting in Wyan's bank account, converted into Indonesian rupiah, a currency that has a history of crashing without notice and turning to vapor. And Wyan is supposed to get evicted from her shop in September, which is around the time I leave the country, which is in about 3 weeks. But it's turning out to be almost impossible for Wyan to find a piece of land she deems appropriate for a home. Setting aside all the practical considerations, she has to examine the taksu, the spirit of each place. As a healer, Wyan's sense of taksu, even by Balinese standards, is supremely acute. I found one place that I thought was perfect, but Wyan said it was possessed by angry demons. The next piece of land was rejected because it was too close to a river, which, as everyone knows, is where ghosts live. The night after she saw that place, Wyan says, she dreamt of a beautiful woman in torn clothes, weeping, and that did it. We could not buy this land. Then we found a lovely little shop near town with a backyard and everything, but it was located on a corner, and only somebody who wants to go bankrupt and die young would ever live in a house located on a corner, as everyone knows. "Don't even try talking her out of it," Felipe advised me. "Trust me, darling. Don't get between the Balinese and their taksu." Then, last week, Felipe found a place that seemed to fit the criteria exactly. A small, pretty piece of land, close to central Ubud, on a quiet road, next to a rice field, plenty of space for a garden, and well within our budget. When I asked Wyan, should we buy it, she replied, "Don't know yet, Liz. Not too fast for making decisions like this. I need to talk to a priest first." She explained that she would need to consult a priest in order to find an auspicious day upon which to purchase the land, if she does decide to buy it at all, because nothing significant can be done in Bali before an auspicious day is chosen. But she can't even ask the priests for an auspicious date upon which to buy the land until she decides if she really wants to live there, which is a commitment she refuses to make until she's had an auspicious dream. Aware of my dwindling days here, I asked Wyan, like a good New Yorker, "How soon can you arrange to have an auspicious dream?" Wyan, like a good Balinese, replied, "Cannot be rushed this." Although, she mused, it might help if she could go to one of the major temples in Bali with an offering and pray to the gods to bring her an auspicious dream. "Okay," I said. Tomorrow, Felipe can drive you to the major temple and you can make an offering and ask the gods to please send you an auspicious dream. Wyan would love to, she said. It's a great idea. Only one problem. She's not permitted to enter any temples for this entire week because she is menstruating. 104. Maybe I'm not getting across how fun all this is. Truly, it's so much odd and satisfying fun trying to figure all this out. Or maybe I'm just enjoying this surreal moment in my life so much because I happen to be falling in love, and that always makes the world seem delightful, no matter how insane your reality. I always liked Felipe, but there's something about the way he takes on the saga of Wyan's house that brings us together during the month of August like a real couple. It's none of his concern, of course, what happens to this trippy Balinese medicine woman. He's a businessman. He's managed to live in Bali for 5 years without getting too entwined in the personal lives and complex rituals of the Balinese. But suddenly here he is, wading with me through muddy rice paddies, trying to find a priest who will give Wyan an auspicious date. I was perfectly happy in my boring life before you came along, he always says. He was bored in Bali before. He was languid and killing time, a character from a Graham Greene novel. That indolence stopped the moment we were introduced. Now that we're together, I get to hear Felipe's version of how we met, a delicious story I never tire of hearing, about how he saw me at the party that night, standing with my back to him, and how I did not even need to turn my head and show him my face before he had realized somewhere in his gut, "That is my woman. I will do anything to have that woman." "And it was easy to get you," he says. "All I had to do was beg and plead for weeks." "You didn't beg and plead. You didn't notice me begging and pleading?" He talks about how we went dancing that first night we met, and how he watched me get all attracted to that cute Welsh guy, and how his heart sank as he saw the scene unfolding, thinking, "I'm putting all this work into seducing this woman, and now that handsome young guy is just going to take her away from me and bring so much complication into her life. If only she knew how much love I could offer her." Which he can. He's a caregiver by nature, and I can feel him going into a kind of orbit around me, making me the key directional setting for his compass, growing into the role of being my attendant knight. Felipe is the kind of man who desperately needs a woman in his life, but not so that he can be taken care of, only so that he can have someone to care for, someone to consecrate himself to. Having lived without such a relationship ever since his marriage ended, he's been adrift in life recently. But now he is organizing himself around me. It's lovely to be treated this way, but it also scares me. I hear him downstairs sometimes making me dinner as I am lounging upstairs reading, and he's whistling some happy Brazilian samba, calling up, "Darling, would you like another glass of wine?" And I wonder if I am capable of being somebody's son, somebody's everything. Am I centered enough now to be the center of somebody else's life? But when I finally brought up the topic with him one night, he said, "Have I asked you to be that person, darling? Have I asked you to be the center of my life?" I was immediately ashamed of myself for my vanity, for having assumed that he wanted me to stay with him forever so that he could indulge my whims till the end of time. "I'm sorry," I said. "That was a little arrogant, wasn't it?" "A little," he acknowledged, then kissed my ear. "But not much, really. Darling, of course it's something we have to discuss, because here's the truth. I'm wildly in love with you." I blanched in reflex, and he made a quick joke, trying to be reassuring. "I mean that in a completely hypothetical way, of course." But then he said in all seriousness, "Look, I'm 52 years old. Believe me, I already know how the world works. I understand that you don't love me yet the way I love you, but the truth is I don't really care. For some reason, I feel the same way about you that I felt about my kids when they were small, that it wasn't their job to love me. It was my job to love them. You can decide to feel however you want to, but I love you, and I will always love you. Even if we never see each other again, you already brought me back to life, and that's a lot. And of course, I'd like to share my life with you. The only problem is I'm not sure how much of a life I can offer you in Bali." This is a concern I've had, too. I've been watching the expatriate society in Ubud, and I know for a stone-cold fact that this is not the life for me. Everywhere in this town, you see the same kind of character. Westerners who have been so ill-treated and badly worn by life that they've dropped the whole struggle and decided to camp out here in Bali indefinitely, where they can live in a gorgeous house for 200